So what does the American dream mean these days? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our next guest, New York Times bestselling author Jonathan Evason. His novels include lots of novels. West of Here, This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance. He's just released his new book. It's called Lawn Boy. And in it, he takes a look at the American dream through the eyes of a 22-year-old Chicano man who is an aspiring landscape artist. So I really enjoyed reading the book. I think you will as well. And the American dream, what's the American dream like for you? Has it changed over the years? Do you think you need money to get ahead, or is it hard work? Is that enough? And Jonathan Evason, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
I really did enjoy reading your book. And maybe just to start, for our listeners' benefit, what's the basic story here of Lawn Boy?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to write a novel about class in America, just to sort of tackle that bugaboo, and I always kind of figured that I would take a wider approach, you know, kind of write a multi-generational saga across time and space. And until I arrived at this voice of a 22-year-old landscaper, and I realized that I really just started writing Mike as a blog, the character's a blog, because I was under contract for a book that I was supposed to be delivering, and I decided to throw the book away. I just wasn't happy with it. The center didn't hold, and I was terrified to tell my publisher or my agent or anybody else. And so I was feeling kind of just sort of hemmed in by the career elements of my writing, which was never what it was about when I started. So I decided I needed to just write something. And so I started this anonymous blog called Mike Munoz Saves the World. It was like a really, you know, purposefully ugly 90s, monkey crap, brown, endless scrolling, bad HTML, corny little lawnmower gifts website, in which this 22-year-old, you know, biracial landscaper basically just sort of grinds his axes about wealth and equity and social injustice, and, you know, talks about his passion for landscaping. And so I just started typing in Mike's voice, and after about 20,000 words, I actually decided, you know, this is all I need to write this novel, is this one irreverent working-class voice. Everything was there to put the issue of class in America into fine focus. You know, you've got a broke kid working in gated communities for rich people. So you get to kind of see both sides of the fences, and you get to see firsthand how, you know, class and race can, you know, thwart the American dream, along with identity politics and just the, you know, crushing effects of capitalism. And so the book just ended up being, just kind of a progress report on the American dream, what it means for young people today.
Yeah. You know, as I was reading the book, I was thinking a lot of another writer, Michael Perry. I don't know if you've ever read any of his books.
I thought he was the singer of Journey.
Well, he has some bestsellers. That was a big bestseller was Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time. But I guess you guys write in a similar style in that, at least for and certainly in this book, is that he and you write in a way that really respects people of regardless of where they come from or their education or what kind of a job they've got, they're treated with a respect that is refreshing.
Yeah, well, you know, the working man, and you know, I come from a single mom, working class family, single mom of four, and, you know, I mean, the working class has always been treated either, you know, in literature and in art in general in America as either been sort of patronized or ennobled, like their poverty has been somehow ennobled. And I just wanted to write a modern realism sort of take on that. And, you know, it's really kind of the story of my life. You know, I mean, I started writing novels when I was 19, and I wrote maybe, you know, six or eight of the things before anybody published me. But in the meantime, you know, all I did was work menial jobs. And I telemarketed sunglasses. I sorted rotten tomatoes for the United Grocers. I checked gas meters. I worked the car lots. I worked as a bartender, a waiter, a bus person. I worked at, you know, just any job you can think of, and a landscaper, and a caregiver, and all of which have been, like, invaluable to me in terms of, like, accruing experience, because I'm not one of those writers that went to an MFA program and, you know what I mean? My you know, most of my writing comes from experience, so... Like, even suffering through those jobs, I had the benefit Mike didn't, of being able to know that at least, you know, I could polish this turd and probably use it somewhere in my work somewhere, you know, relive it and
well,
use it for something besides the minimum wage.
Well, just back to Mike Perry for a minute, because he says all of his books are really kind of autobiographies, because he writes about what he knows and how he's lived and how he interacts with people. That certainly, given your background, right on target. Well, you've got in the book, you got Mike Munoz. You've got his brother, who has
Nate is his developmentally disabled older brother, so kind of like a younger brother. Mike happened to be his caregiver most of his life.
Yeah, and then you've got Remy, one of his childhood friends. You got Freddie. I really liked Freddie in a lot of ways, the mom's boyfriend and mom.
Yeah, Freddie's maybe one of my favorite characters ever, because he's you know, he's sort of this portly black dude who's a doorman at the bar mom, but so he looks like a kind of a clown on the surface, but he's actually a really noble character.
Yeah, he is indeed, and plays a kind of a pivotal role in the book, especially, well, I've actually throughout the book. He gives he's there for some support and a lot of help and provides some bigger help right near the end of the book. Well, it's set at Bainbridge Island, which is an actual place.
Yep, I'm sitting there right now. I grew up here, and you know, my dad, my old man moved us up here. He got himself a transferred from Lockheed to Keyport back in the 70s, and he just kind of left us. You know, my sister died in a freak accident a couple years earlier, and my parents' marriage was starting to come apart, so my dad got a transfer up here and just left my mom with the four of us, and then got himself a transfer back to California, and for whatever reason, he chose kind of an affluent community for us, and we were not affluent. So it was, you know, I kind of grew up, you know, a lot of my friends had more money, and, you know, I wasn't doing the ski bus like them, and, you know, I was kind of embarrassed to where I lived. You know, I'd have people drop me off at the end of the driveway and that kind of thing. But, you know, it gave me, and people were very nice. I mean, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it kind of gave me a lens to view class in a way.
Yeah.
Just being on the have-not side of the equation.
Yeah. You have reservations about writing about real places, or?
No. I mean, you know, I got a shirt I wear says, you know, be careful or you'll wind up in my novel. a little caveat, you know, I wear it to barbecues because people always want to tell me stories. I got a story for you, and I'm like, have at it, man, but you ought to know, you know. I may not use your story. I just might use you. That's why I became my legal guy told me, man, yeah, you made me become an S-Corp and LLC just in case somebody decides to come after me. They can't take my house. It's a little, you know, I do, most of my characters are amalgams, you know what I mean? So I don't really just take somebody, like Freddie, for instance. Freddie's kind of an amalgam of a couple of guys I worked with over the years, one of whom was named Freddie and was a doorman, and another guy was this delivery driver named Ben. You know, so he's kind of an amalgam. And then another thing I do is I use a lot of, like, I'll use names from my high school yearbook, and I don't assign them characters that are like the people, but I just do that because then they buy, like, 20 books. You know what I mean? I'm constantly throwing in, I use those names. And I also use very long acknowledgments, you know, because if you thank, like, three pages worth of people, they all buy 10 books. That's how you sell books, man, one at a time. You do that, you end up in the New York Times bestseller list because it doesn't take as many books as people think.
Well, you are a lot like Michael Perry, because he has similar ways of marketing himself and marketing his books.
Hey, man, saving pennies to make dimes. That's the working class way.
Yeah.
Things one at a time. Nobody teaches you how to think real big. You just learn to think incrementally.
Yeah, and you don't think about money.
Yeah, well, nobody teaches you about money. That's the thing about growing up with no money. It's like trying to learn how to play Monopoly without money. And, nobody told me. My dad was a bodybuilder before he left. And, he taught me that the world was made of meat. You know what I mean? That was the kind of, and then I started living in a more affluent community and realizing that these kids, these young kids, they looked at destiny as this ladder they could just climb. And, it took me a long time to learn. It took me well into my, 30s to learn that you have to value yourself,
Yeah. And hold that thought. We'll take a quick look at the news and we'll be back. Stay with us. So what does the American dream mean to you these days? What does success mean in today's world to you? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Those are some of the themes that are found in the book Lawn Boy by Jonathan Evason. He's written a number of bestsellers. His novels include West of Here, for example, This Is Your Life, Area Chance, Lawn Boy. And in it, he takes a look at the American dream through the eyes of a 22-year-old Chicano man who is, he's an aspiring landscape artist, and he's inspirational too, I guess. What do you think you need to be successful in America? Jonathan, Teresa on Facebook quoted George Carlin about the American dream. He said, "You have to be asleep to believe it."
Yeah, I mean, I guess the old model, you do. I mean, if we're talking about the sort of post-war, mid-20th century, everybody with a two-car garage, 3.5 kids, single-income family that can support your kids and send them to college, yeah, you would have to be asleep. I think now it's more about it's not as prevalent as it once was. I almost feel like it takes sort of an extraordinary person to achieve some sort of American dream. Like you have to, you have to engage the world on your own terms, as Mike learns,
Yeah.
You gotta get past the capitalistic model, past all the identity politics, decide what you want to do. And just earlier I was alluding to the fact that, when I was growing up, I learned that these kids that grew up with money, they learned to just say no to things, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. If they felt that they were beneath them, because they had that luxury. They had money, so they didn't have to work a job they didn't want to. They could value themselves, and that's really hard to do when, you grow up in a household where your mom's working two jobs and you're sleeping at the library after school. And it took me until my mid-30s to learn that. I was doing some TV writing, and I was writing this thing for a sports network, and the producer, it was on spec, they were trying to get it produced, and the producer, I happened to know the exact producer, but the producer that was hiring me, she sat me down and she's like, "Well, we want you to be the head writer on this thing, and we've got $1,200 a month to pay you." And I was like, "Okay, well, I'm going to have to, let me just sit on this." Didn't give her an answer, which, I wouldn't have done at any other point in my life. But I said, "Yep, $1,200, I'll take it. This is a great opportunity for me," kind of thing. I said, "Nope." And then I went and I called the executive producer, who I knew. I said, "Hey, man, let's have lunch." And I sat down with him and I told him my ideas, and I knew he was really excited about it. I knew he really wanted me to do this project. And then I said to him, "That's going to be $12,000 a month." And he didn't even bat an eye. He just said, "Done." It took me 3.5 decades. It took my family 13 generations, to learn that lesson, to just value yourself. This guy didn't bat an eye. I asked for 10 times more money, and the signal that sent to him is, that guy must be good. He knows what he wants. Just a lesson as simple as this is really hard for a kid that grows up in a working-class family to learn.
Yeah, I read an essay about the book. You said in that, capitalism is not exactly teeming with possibilities. I can't remember exactly. If you lack money, if you lack capital. Yeah, so.
You just left with the ism.
That's right. Talk about, and the lack of money, what it does, can do for ambition or not.
Well, like, I mean, my family had, you know, there's one thing I can thank my family for in terms of, you know, we never had any money, but we always had some free thinking about, we always wanted to work for ourselves. You know, generations of Edison men wanted to work for themselves, so we started these terrible businesses. I mean, it's not that the businesses were terrible, it's just that our business model was always, invariably, you know, if you want to get business, just undercut the, you know, bid lower than everybody else. And of course, you know, I mean, it seems to make sense to somebody with no money. That makes sense. Bid lower than everybody else, and you're going to get the jobs. The problem is you can't even cover your own overhead. You're always digging a hole, and then you start working for rich people who are going to do something like, you know, I hear these horror stories like, you know, general contractors, you know, honest working guys just trying to get by, building some, you know, working on some mansion for some, you know, robber baron, and like, the wife can't decide what she wants on floors for floors, you know, so yeah. Everything's getting held up for a couple weeks or something. And then they go over past their deadline. And then the robber baron sues the contractor for going over, you know, so the contractor ends up having to owe the rich. But, you know, this is how it works for, you know,
a lot of times,
it's not an even playing field.
Well, we've got Gary online, from Ween. Gary, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, first, I'd like to thank Jonathan for the book, West of Here. I read it this winter and enjoyed it. I'd been to the Olympic Peninsula numerous times, hiking and camping over the years. And it took a little bit with the time changes in the book to get adjusted, but once I got into that flow, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And hey, I just finished the companion novel. It won't be out for a couple years, but you'll be glad to know it. This one takes place in the North Cascades, and it's a similar thing. It's got a bifurcated timeline, and part of it takes place in like 13,000 BC on the Cordilleran Ice Sheet, and part of it takes place in modern day. But I look at it as a companion novel to West of Here because it's a big multi-voiced, multi-generational epic, and it's very much set and, you know, it's very much a novel of place.
Sure, and you're writing about the Elwha River and taking the dam out. I followed that in Environmental Magazine. So I have a quick story to tell you. Years ago, I was at a dinner with a friend, and it was honoring incoming and retiring teachers in a local city. And we were sitting across the table from the editor and the wife of a local weekly paper. And she thought that I was either a retiring or coming in teacher. And she asked my educational background, and I told her what I had my degrees in. And then she said to me, well, where do you teach? And I said, well, I don't teach. I said, I drive truck for a living. And she looked at me and she said, isn't that a terrible waste of your education? And I leaned forward to her, and I said, I use my education every day. I just don't use it for financial gain. And her jaw physically dropped open, and my friend thought I'd said something really terrible. But the point is, life, Thoreau said it best, the man is richest whose pleasures are cheapest. So if you're
listen, I've been a driver. I've never driven a truck, but I was a delivery driver. It's a pretty good job, man. I mean, especially for somebody like me that has a life of the mind, I mean, you get stretches of hours and hours at a time where your mind is free and you can, you know.
Yeah.
Gary, thank you so much for your call today. I really, really appreciate it. And, well, you know what? Let's just go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Dennis, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Based on what I've been reading is, to succeed for the American dream, whatever, we need to mix information, imagination, and ideas with purpose and plans, because there are investors who are waiting for ideas to invest in.
Yeah, I guess that's one model of it. It's kind of a capitalist model. I'm not going to wait around for some guy with money to bankroll me and then split the profits with me, man. I believe in just making your own way. Be your own, you know. how you're going to get that capital, I don't know. I just think about that guy out in the San Bernardino Valley who saved his money for 39 years because he wanted to make his dream come true, and that was to build a big gosh dang cement brontosaurus in the middle of the desert. By God, he did it.
He did.
I don't know, man. I think, I don't know. For me, the American dream is not really about finance or, you know, I don't know. For me, it's just about defining yourself within the context of the world and your own, you know. I don't think it's about financial, you know. Right now, my American dream isn't looking so good, man. I'm 7 cities into a 21-city tour. I've got vertigo. My kids don't recognize me. But, you know, once this is over and I get to get back into my garage and write books again, that's what the American dream looks like.
But, you know, in your book, Lawn Boy, I'm thinking there, sitting there thinking, here is Mike. He's a really good at lawn care and topiary and things like that. He's working for other people who, you know, wind up shafting him a bit or more than a bit. I kept thinking, why doesn't he just start his own job, his own business? And is there something about the lack of not having money to begin with or how you were raised that kind of puts a block in your brain when it comes to that sometimes?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like we were talking about. I mean, capitalism requires capital, and if you don't have capital, I mean, it's just, look, when I was working in telemarketing, you know, telemarketing rooms with real struggling people in the 80s in Silicon Valley, back when you could actually telemarket it, people wouldn't hang up on you. They'd listen to you for a minute while you tried to sell them a fire safety guide or some, you know, UV sunglasses or something. And a lot of these people that I worked with in the phone rooms, they were down on their luck. And so they would be living out of tenant hotels. But tenant hotels was expensive, you know. I mean, they were paying like, you know, $250 a week. They're paying like, you know, $1,000 a month to live in this hotel. And it didn't allow them to save money to, you know. Yeah. It didn't allow, I mean, without capital in the equation, it's just really, really hard to get ahead. I mean, you know. And right now we live in an era with, you know, there's more wealth consolidation now than any time since the 1860s. I mean, the haves have everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I drive down any street in America, you drive down, I take the ferry to Seattle, and, you know, under every single viaduct or overpass, man, there is just tent after tent after tent. And these aren't just homeless people and mentally ill people. These, I mean, we've got, you know, chefs and adjunct professors and people working two jobs living in their cars because rents are so high, they can't get ahead. They can't get ahead to get enough money to have a first and month, you know, first and last month's rent and a deposit.
Yeah. Deborah in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Hi. Oh, I tuned in late, but I'm sure glad I tuned in. I took notes, and this is what I wrote down. Well, I sailed to England and to all the islands in the Caribbean, and what I realized, that was like 30 years ago, but I realized we're all spoiled Americans. Even the poorest of us, and here's what else I wrote. You couldn't pay me $1 million for my memories. I had such a happy childhood. I mean, I think, what if someone offered me $1 million for my memories? Would I take it? I wouldn't. I just think they're so precious. Mm. And I remember listening to public radio, and I was at a different house. My son was at his dad's house, and he was 10. And he called me up and he says, "Mom, you have to turn this on. This guy put all his stuff in storage and is living in his truck to save money." And I was listening to the same show, and it's like I think of that all the time. I'm like, who can afford an apartment? But I mean, it really is. It seems to be all about money. But I know I will not allow money to be the source of my happiness. And it's harder than it seems.
Yeah,
it is. Good for you.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Well, what's the American dream for you, Jonathan?
I'm living it, just not really this month. Like I said, I've got a little vertigo, and I'm just traveling to a different city every night. It's a little exhausting. I come home, my kids hardly remember me. But, you know, my dream is to do exactly what I want, to be able to present myself as who I am, like on social networking, for instance. I can talk about whatever I want. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to worry about what my employer is going to think about me or how I'm presenting myself. I can put myself out there, fly my freak flag as high as I want, and people can accept me or they cannot accept me. And if they don't accept me, that's great, because I can only have 5,000 of them on my Facebook or whatever anyway. So I just weed out the ones that I offend, whether it's my politics or, you know, whatever. I can just say that stuff, and if I alienate anybody, well, that's fine. I get to – that's what it's about for me, just to totally be myself and to write books about myself. Yeah, or, I mean, not about myself, but to write the books I want to write, you know. The more success you have – at something, the more that people outside want to handle you and say, well, this worked, let's go back to the well, let's write something like that. And so that's why I always stay one or two books ahead.
I was just going to ask you about that. I was going to comment, oh my goodness, you've already got a book done and you're out on the tour with
I would have had two books done, except I threw the one away I was telling you about. I'd be two books ahead, you know. I mean, and that's part of controlling my dream, you know. As that leaves me in control. Look, the book is written. You can't try to influence what I'm going to do, what I'm going to put out there. That, to me, is the most important thing, is just to be able to own your identity and be true to yourself, you know, and not get wrapped up in all this capitalist consumer crap that you know, basically just programs you to be dissatisfied, as, you know, the Stones so astutely pointed out in 1965, you know?
Well, you know, I really enjoy your writing style. Here's what I like about your style. You know, you're funny. There's some funny parts in the book, but things are going along and they're breezing along, and then suddenly, oh, so you get like, oh, you got knocked over the head with something here that sort of stops you in your tracks a little bit, and then it kind of starts up again.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think so much of what we draw pleasure at as readers is like to have our expectations undermined, to be surprised. And so, you know, if you can kind of go along with this buoyant tone, and, you know, comedy and tragedy are always inextricably linked. Otherwise, it's not funny. You know, it's not funny when a white guy makes black jokes. It's not funny when a skinny guy makes, you know, fat jokes. I mean, there's always going to be pain underneath a good comedy, but you can sort of lull the reader in with this sort of comic buoyant tone, and then you could bring the tragedy right up through the center of it and just punch him in the gut, and it could be pretty powerful.
Yeah, punch in the gut, that's a good term for it, actually. I was thinking a knock on the head, but a punch in the gut is better as far as I'm concerned. Well, well, you know what, I'm going to go to Camille here. I had a question for you, but let's see what's on Camille's mind in New Berlin. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be real brief. When you talk about poor people not having any options, this was back in 1965. My mom had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and because of that, she was undergoing a lot of treatments. We had no money coming in the house. She was too sick to go and reapply for welfare benefits, so we had no money coming in. We got news of somebody who was paying people to fold letters. This is before the automatic folding machines.
Yep.
If we filled all these letters and put them in the envelopes, they would pay us per envelope. So we had boxes and boxes of envelopes piled all around, folding letters, putting them in. And when they came to pick up the envelopes, they said, oh, you didn't fold these letters right. And they took all the boxes and paid us not a penny. We don't have any resources to protest this. And that's really one of those. But on the plus side, after she died, I did qualify for Social Security benefits, and that got me through college for my teaching degree.
And, you know, I mean, thank God for these benefits. And I'm getting really tired of people complaining about benefits and thinking that like rights and opportunities are like some kind of pie, and if somebody else has that opportunity, it's going to take it away from you. I mean, you know, I don't know what's wrong with some people. I just don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know, I'm doing better. I pay more in taxes now than I ever made a year in my life before 10 years ago. And, I'm just paying it forward constantly, man. I'm not going to hoard my money away. That's another thing growing up poor teaches you, man. It's just going to go away eventually anyway. So, you know, you may as well use it for good things. I mean, I give a disproportionate amount of money to charitable causes or just friends who are down on their luck or be generous with my time. Like, I must mentor about two dozen writers who can't afford to go to MFA programs, like, you know, because it costs kids 30, 40, 50 grand to go to a Masters of Fine Art writing program. So I'm working on now, I'm trying to work on starting a scholarship for kids that don't have those academic opportunities. Besides, I want to see kids, you know, I want to see novels written by kids that work in factories and kids that are working as landscapers and kids that are installing heating ducts and laying drywall. I mean, I kind of want the novel to take a turn like, you know, what Charles Dickens did to the Victorian novel in the 18th century. It was all about the landed gentry and their boring love triangles until Dickens came along, started writing about child labor, and started using the novel as, you know, to write about the people on the street. And these are the novels I want to read. I don't know what's happened, but, like, populist fiction has kind of died in this country, man. All the stories are coming out of the classroom, and it's all about the distressed sentence and the prismatic narrative structure and all this crafty stuff, man. But I want to read about real stuff. You go back a couple of generations, and you got a guy like, say, look at Hemingway. I mean, he was basically just a Trustafarian. His family had money, but he still had the good sense to go drive an ambulance in somebody else's war, you know? He still knew he had to go out and accrue some experience. You know, Jack London went up to the Klondike, dug for freaking gold, you know? I mean, people, I'm just tired of reading books by people who aren't really doing anything but writing books or sitting in a classroom. So I'm trying to create opportunities for people that don't have those opportunities available then so they can be empowered so we can hear those voices. Because those are the voices I think we need to hear more than ever. That's us, man. They call it the 1%, but it's really more like the 0, you know, the 0.005%. That's where most of your wealth is consolidated.
Yeah. Well, I really do think you should read pick up a book of Michael Perry because he writes the way you want. He's most of his.
Yeah, I'll have to now.
His most of his isn't fiction. It's mostly about his own life and who he works with. But you have done an absolutely marvelous job with Lawn Boy, and I got to tell you, Jonathan, it's the first of your books I've read, but now I have to go back and read the others.
Well, I do appreciate that, Larry. I think you like the Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving a lot too. Just don't see the movie. But read the book before you see the movie.
All right. Mike, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed
Thanks for having me, Larry, and thanks for your callers.
Thank you so much. Jonathan Evison, isn't he a fun guy to listen to and talk with? I really enjoyed reading his book and talking with him today, and I hope you did as well. I'm Larry Mueller, glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network today.